never did a thing to me. So I don't eat red meat or white fish. Don't give me no blue cheese. We're all members of the animal kingdom. Leave your brothers and sisters in the sea.
Most of us believe that what's behind our current ecological crisis is global warming. However, my guest today on the Peace and Social Justice Program argues that it's not global warming per se, but instead speciesism and capitalism that are the two driving forces behind our ecological crisis. We'll speak with philosopher John Sanbanmatsu, author of the forthcoming book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life, on today's Peace and Social Justice Program. First up, we check in with Chico Friends on the Street to get the latest on the city's failure in response to our homeless crisis. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program for Friday, August 20th, 2021. I'm Robert Jones. First up on the program, a conversation I had with Patrick Newman, founder of Chico Friends on the Street, to fill us in on the latest goings-on with the City Council regarding the homeless crisis in Chico. Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Good to be here again, Robert.
For those of our listeners who are not familiar with Chico Friends on the Street, can you give us a quick little background on the organization and your role in it?
The point of Chico Friends on the Street has been to move the consciousness of Chico on the subject of homeless human rights in the public space. So that's a pretty narrow area that has to do with what people are experiencing in what I call the failure zone, which is that zone where a person is not going to be housed tonight. Everything else has failed, and our irresponsible and immoral distribution of wealth in America has led to people, you know, mostly disabled, walking the streets. What, do they have restroom access? Are they being criminalized for being there? Do they have access to food and clothing on an emergency basis? And how is our community responding to that person who's out there pushing the cart at 3 a.m? That's the focus of Chico Friends on the Street. It's never been very well understood, but that's kind of what we do.
Can you give us a little rundown of the state of the homeless situation here in the city?
Right now, we have a city government that's, I would say, particularly hostile to the homeless population. We could start with the Warren versus City of Chico case that the Legal Services of Northern California has brought to the Eastern District Court. But as the, you know, we go through this process of having this preliminary injunction, which has stopped the city of Chico from sweeping people essentially from any of the public properties that Chico has, any of our parks, we're in a situation now where people are sheltering in place, which was allowed under Chico City policy right when the COVID era began, which is like March of 2020. And that's the current state. So we've got, you know, people kind of camping more and more around town. We have people who are camping in City Plaza, for that matter. But the main largest campground is still at Comanche Creek, where probably 100 people camp, and conditions are horrible. And I think that's something that we probably ought to take more seriously as a community. But
I'm wondering if you can give us an update on the latest happenings surrounding the city council meetings and the homeless situation.
Sure. So from this homeless human rights perspective, I think it's important to talk briefly about, you know, what the composition of the city council today. We had two resignations, Scott Huber and Cami Denele both resigned for very different reasons. Scott was a voice of reason and a solid advocate for people on the streets. He's gone now. So there's two new appointments. Our former police chief, Mike O'Brien, got one of the seats. And Dale Bennett, who was on the planning commission, got the other seat. So now we have a council that's 6-1, very visibly, I would say, authoritarian on homeless issues. So when we look at those two appointments, I would just say really briefly, thinking about who they are, Mike O'Brien, I mean, I have nothing personal against about, you know, with any of these people, but his whole history is one of looking at what's called broken windows policing for his law enforcement philosophy, his law enforcement methodology. And that has been true throughout his entire career as chief, which started in about 6 or 7 years ago. And then he was chief until about a year ago. So we know a lot about Mike O'Brien because we can look at what he pushed for during the time he was chief. He pushed for more criminalization laws, and his approach has been to make life on the streets as criminal as possible. And I think his goal in doing that is to try to manage the homeless population from that broken windows point of view, which is these are poor people. They commit a lot of what are called social crimes, which are things that are really essentially, blight on the city landscape. And that means sleeping in public, you know, public urination, defecation, drinking, smoking, all the things that you see in the community when you put a bunch of impoverished people on the streets. Well, so there's different philosophies and approaches to how you deal with that. And Mike O'Brien's approach has always been, I think, a very authoritarian approach. Again, this isn't a personal thing with Mike O'Brien. It's just that we know about him because, you know, he was one of the main drivers behind the offenses against public property ordinance in 2015. He was right there promoting it and was one of the architects of it. What's happened since? Well, we have a federal judge telling us that these laws are unconstitutional. So there's a problem with appointing Mike O'Brien to a council that's already heavily weighted toward authoritarianism. The other counselor, Bennett, I don't know much about him other than, you know, some quotes where he was asked when he applied for the appointment to the council, his thoughts on homelessness. And the one thing that I remember was that he said that it's climate that's the problem, that our climate here draws a lot of people to Chico. And that is an explanation for why we have so many people on our streets. Well, that's just not a reasonable or deeply thought out position. So I think that it's pretty clear we have two new appointments who are going to be doubling down on the positions that the council has been pursuing, especially since this new council was elected. And you can see it in what happened at the last council meeting, which, you know, I've got my notes here and, you know, go through what happened at the meeting. There was three items that came up and all of them revealed where we're at with, you know, the homeless situation in this new council.
And I want to go over those in just a minute. I'm speaking with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a homeless and human rights advocacy organization. We'll come back to those points in just a moment. I need to let the listeners know that the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day, right on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available, at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. Patrick Newman, you mentioned that there are a number of council agenda items that are of particular relevance to the homeless situation here. Can you give us a run through of where we stand?
Sure. So let's just go through the laundry list. There was item 2.1, 5.1, and 5.2. And before we go through that list, let me say that I was really happy to see an unusually large number of speakers at this meeting. August 3rd came from the community or to show up and speak on all three of these. And there were quite a few strong voices that I think spoke on behalf of, you know, a reasonable, sane, and principled approach to these homeless issues. So I was really happy to see that. Sometimes you go there on really important things and it's one or two people who speak, and that night it was more like 8 or 10. So that was great. So going through them, 2.1 was block grant funding. And one of the more disturbing elements in that was that this several hundred thousand dollars. 50,000 of that, almost 50,000, was being given to an organization called Point of Contact, which really has, well, the members of Point of Contact are very similar in their view to members of Chico First. So they're an authoritarian group. They do not believe in supplying anything to the homeless in the, of a material nature, and they say so. They see all that as enabling. So you're giving $50,000 to Point of Contact to do what? Well, to go out and profile and direct people on the streets towards services. This is a long-standing, I don't know what to call it. It's a ruse. It's dishonest. It's the way we avoid really the truth of what we're doing here, is that we send people out. And this has been going on the whole time I've been interested in this subject. We used to go out. They used to go out and go, well, you know, here, you know, you go up and you, you know, you interview somebody and you find out about them, and then you're supposedly going to solve some kind of problem by doing this profiling and telling them about services. Well, the problem with all of that is that the services aren't there in any meaningful sense. The shelters or housing is definitely not there in any meaningful sense. So what you're doing is you're referring people to services that don't exist, and then possibly, you know, you can direct people toward Torres or the Jesus Center shelter. Those are both high barrier shelters where a person can get temporary high density sheltering in a transition center, but ultimately there's no transitioning to anywhere, because the fundamental issue that we always come back to is that, you know, we need 500,000, you know, dwelling units on the West Coast of the United States right now that we don't have. So what ends up happening with groups like Point of Contact is that they end up working closely with Chico PD. They become an appendage of Chico PD, or they already are. And so this council, by giving $50,000 of this block grant money to this group, makes a very clear statement that they're, you know, supporting a group that has no human rights moral compass whatsoever. The other group that they are giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to is called Caring Choices. I've had some contact with some of them. I don't know what their human rights standards are. They haven't articulated them in any meaningful way publicly, so that leaves me wondering about them holding hands with the city. The city tends to give money to people who are not going to rock the boat or deliver services in the public space effectively. So those of us who do, who have spent years trying to meet people's needs in the public space and have seen, you know, like the Jesus Center soup kitchen just go away, where you have no barrier access to food and clothing, there's desperation on the streets. And so it's hard to watch hundreds of thousands of dollars being given to nonprofits that do not have this as their core mission when you get zero. So, but that's kind of been the status quo all along. So there were a lot of us there who voiced our opposition to especially giving money to Point of Contact, and that absolutely fell on deaf ears. So that was a 6-1 vote. The next one was 5.1, and that was municipal code changes, mostly having to do storage laws. So right now, with the Martin v. City of Chico case, the judge has been signaling pretty strongly, quite clearly, that he doesn't think that the City of Chico's laws are constitutional or in conformance with, you know, constitutional standards. So what we got was our city attorney, Vince Ewing, who was actually the author of the 2015 Offenses Against Public Property Ordinance. So CitLie, he was also involved with that, but the more comprehensive, multifaceted criminalization laws that affected a lot of our codes in 2015, and these are the ones that are, I think, the most objectionable to the judge. Vince Ewing was a city attorney then. Vince Ewing is back again to Chico. So he drafted some changes to the law, to the codes, and they have to do with sort of spelling out some more specifics about where people can store and how they can store. And as I read through them, my impression was, and along with everyone else who spoke that night, was that these are tweaks to the law that aren't really good faith efforts to reform Chico's criminalization codes. So that's really complicated, because there's so many criminalization codes and they're used in so many different ways. But what it is, it's, I think it's another gambit. And in my mind, it's sort of the legal equivalent of what we did at the airport, which is, well, we're going to do a letter of the law change here where we mark out 500 spaces on a tarmac and then try to get the judge to buy off on this idea that Chico has, you know, reformed itself and actually taken, you know, shelter alternatives seriously. Well, the judge saw right through that, and I hope the judge sees right through this, because it was not a serious effort to reform Chico's criminalization laws. Item 5.2 was hiring Paul Webster as a consultant to the city of Chico. He has started a new brand called Hope Street. They're going to give him $50,000, or the proposal was to give him $50,000. And this was sort of like on the heels of the resignation of Susie Cochums, who is our homeless coordinator for Chico. When I spoke on 5.2, the first thing I asked is, where's Susie Cochums? Why don't we have her here tonight telling us something about what she learned in her months trying to be the homeless coordinator for Chico? Because she had extensive experience, and that's why she was hired and why she came in. But instead of having Susie Cochums come and give us that important information so that we could learn something from what she experienced, it's absolute silence. People just disappear. You never hear a word about what they experienced. Instead, we bring in a right-wing consultant who's has a history of working with Robert Marbutt in the Trump administration. His position is essentially that there isn't enough incarceration, and that's why we have a homeless problem. If you looked at the Dr. Drew show with Paul Webster on there, you can get his take. He likes this tape called Seattle is Dying. It's a long hit piece, homeless hit piece. And basically, the thesis there is that the reason we have so many homeless people on the streets is because we don't have enough mental health services, and we're not forcing enough people into rehab. So, of course, the opposite end of the spectrum from that is Lloyd Pendleton. And again, it's a wonderful, 20-minute or so TED Talk presentation that you can look up on YouTube. Lloyd Pendleton talks about how until you get somebody sheltered, you really don't know what you're dealing with. So this whole thing with opening more mental institutions, as far as I'm concerned, is a diversion mostly. I'm not saying we don't need more mental health treatment, acute mental health treatment, but it doesn't solve the housing problem. What you're doing is you're diverting off from the main subject, which is lack of affordable housing, and you're saying, look, there's people out there, they're acting crazy, let's lock them up. That's the solution. Well, anybody who has mental health challenges, who's trying to navigate those challenges on the streets without shelter, is going to deteriorate. They're going to decompensate. It's just baked in the cake. That's what happens when you dump people on the streets and they don't get enough food, they don't have decent clothing, they can't sleep at night, they can't find anywhere to use a restroom. What would we expect to see happen to their mental health? Of course it's going to deteriorate. So your baseline has to be shelter, 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 housing, housing, housing. You get people, housed, you try to work with them and being successful at being housed, and then you know what you've got in terms of what you need in facilities that, of the sort that maybe we used to have more of in the past. But instead of going to the problem of housing, what these people with this philosophy do is they skip right over that element because that's too difficult or it's not in conformance with their ideology. And in fact, I think Webster, if I remember right, in that interview with Dr. Drew, he talks about this thing of just, you can't just give people shelter. You can't just give people housing. And so Webster's going to come with this $50,000 and do a study that's not going to be released until 2022. And so that's like on its face, from the perspective of you and me, Robert, who have been in the plaza, that $50,000 is about what we've spent over 5 years trying to meet people's needs for a sleeping bag in the middle of winter or a tarp or all these other things. I know what $50,000 can do. I know how hard it's been to get $50,000, including the pain of taking it out of my own pocket and being part of that $50,000. So to hand this person $50,000 because they say they have these credentials and they're going to come up with some study, I think it's cynical, and it's a way of, from my perspective, not being honest with ourselves about how to have a conversation about what we're doing. Instead, we're throwing out these kinds of actions that appear to be working toward a solution when, in fact, they don't lead to solutions of any kind that I can see.
In closing, can you say just a little bit about the state of Chico Friends on the Street and your role in it?
Yeah, thanks. I've tried in the last few months to dial back a bit from all this. And so fundamentally, instead of being the anchor person that shows up at 12 o'clock every Sunday with, all the lunches and the not all the lunches, but a great many of the lunches and other items, which I've been packing on a weekly basis for 5 years and bringing to the plaza at 12 o'clock sharp. I've sort of backed away from that anchor role, and I'm more showing up inconsistently, let's just say, when it works. I'm putting more energy into showing up at the coffee breakfast event that we have Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the plaza at 9 o'clock. I'm trying to feed that a little bit with some of my energy. The letter writing and going to council meetings and talking to you today, these kinds of things are still, I guess, something I have enough energy to do. But I have described myself for a couple of years as a zombie activist because I feel like this whole task of trying to push for a deeper understanding of what human rights on the streets means has been, it's been difficult. So I'm in a place where I'm still involved, maybe a little bit less so. I'm trying to turn down the volume a little bit. At the same time, that doesn't suggest that there's anything less than a Holocaust happening out there on the streets. In fact, it seems to me it's getting worse. And then as far as the group goes, I mean, there's a strong showing on Sundays. Some of us, I guess, would call ourselves members of Friends on the Street. Some of us wouldn't. Cicery Sherry has been anchoring the breakfast thing 3 days a week. And so that's a Chico Friends on the Street activity. I don't see it being supported as much as it needs to be. So that's something we're going to have to work on.
Well, Patrick Newman, thanks for coming into the studio today and sharing your experience and observations with us.
Thanks, Robert, for another conversation on this subject. I really appreciate it.
John Sanban Matsu is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. His writing has appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, the Detroit Free Press, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Huffington Post, and the Boston Herald. He is the editor of Critical Theory and Animal Liberation and the author of The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject. His forthcoming book is titled The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. Patrick Newman is a writer, environmentalist, and the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a homeless and human rights advocacy organization here in Chico, California. For over 5 years, Chico Friends on the Street has handed out over 10,000 bag lunches and hundreds of blankets, sleeping bags, and boxes of clothing and toiletries at the City Plaza as a protest against the criminalization of poverty and homelessness. In 2018, Newman was named one of Chico News and Review's local heroes. It is my great pleasure to have in the studio with me today Mr. Patrick Newman and via Zoom, Professor John Sanban Matsu, who's calling in from Boston. John and Patrick, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Good to be here, Robert. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, delighted to be here.
John, your forthcoming book, the title is The Omnivore's Deception. What the heck is The Omnivore's Deception?
The full title of the book is The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. And the title is partly a play on a very famous bestseller by the food writer, author Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan has become the go-to guy for food politics in America and internationally. And in 2006, Pollan wrote this book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, in which he grappled with the crisis of animal agriculture and the fact that animal agriculture was ecologically destructive. It had led to kind of losses in our communities, rural communities, corporatization of agriculture, and so on. And Pollan advocated, among other things, a new, what he called a kind of new form of animal agriculture that would be smaller scale. And this book kind of dovetailed with the locavore movement, which perhaps some of your listeners have heard about or participated in, the idea that for environmental reasons and perhaps for reasons of animal welfare, we should eat produce as well as animal products that are from local sources. So my book, as I say, is partly The Omnivore's Deception, is partly a response to Pollan. Well, although it's broader than that, really what it is it's a critique of our cultural obsession with the meat economy, with animal agriculture and the fisheries industries, and with really our domination, our violent domination over other animals. So the deception there has different layers. There are all these deceptive practices, of course, of agribusiness and powerful interests, vested interests in keeping us addicted to these unjust practices. And at the same time, there's self-deception, which is to say we want to believe that we can have our meat and our consciences too, and we can't. At least that's what I argue in this book.
We're speaking with Professor John Sanban Matsu, who's written a book, The Omnivore's Deception. I am also joined in the studio by Patrick Newman. Again, this is from John Sanban Matsu's The Omnivore's Deception. Quoting, half the Earth's land surface is now devoted to agriculture, and 80% of that is devoted either to rearing animals for slaughter or to growing monocrops like corn and soy to feed them. That makes the animal agriculture system the most extensive artifact ever built by Homo sapiens, dwarfing even our roadways and cities. Why have we organized human existence around a totalitarian system of violence? We think of meat as a trivial matter. But what if we were wrong, not just about animals and meat, but about the meaning and purposes of a human life? What if the, quote, animal question was not only not trivial, but the most important question of our time? We love animals one moment, then kill them the next, without seeking to reconcile the two modes of address. This contradiction reveals a fissure within the human condition itself. That's a pretty provocative statement, especially with regard to animal agriculture. I mean, this program broadcasts from Chico, California. It's an agriculture center. There's people here who go to the co-op, local, could they get their heritage pork? They drive their Priuses. They're very good leftists, and they think, well, you know, I'm not really contributing to the destruction of the planet. And when I read your paragraph that I just read, it seems like we're all implicated in a kind of systemic violence of some sort, what you refer to as a totalitarian system. I was wondering if you can speak more about that.
Sure. I mean, this is a complex issue, and there's so many different dimensions to it. And I say it's complex because our entire identity as human beings is organized around, anchored in a kind of refusal of our own animal status and a differentiation, an attempt to differentiate ourselves from all the other species, right, who we view as abject and inferior and unworthy of life at some fundamental level. So we're killing between 1 and 3 trillion animals every year. Most of those animals are killed. They're marine animals, aquatic animals. On land, it's something like 60 to 70 billion mammals and birds. So as I argue in the book, we've essentially turned the earth into a gulag of violence, a prison house and a killing field. And it's so ubiquitous, right, that we don't even think about it. It doesn't even occur to us that it's there. There's a joke. There's two fish. One fish says to the other fish, you know, well, what do you think of the water? And the other fish just doesn't know what the other fish is talking about, you know, like what water? And that's how we are with this system of violence. And so my book really is an attempt to intervene against a kind of emerging common sense view, which is wrong in my view, which is that the problem with animal agriculture and the fisheries is that we're not killing animals in the billions and trillions sustainably. So it's the idea, you know, don't want to be inconvenienced. And more than that, they don't want to give up this identity of us as lords and masters of the universe, our universe, meaning the globe, you know, the earth. I'm trying to shift the discourse a little, as, you know, I'm not the only one. There are others in the animal advocacy movement who take a similar line. But I want to shift the discourse away from sustainability. Because although it's the case, it is the case that animal agriculture and fisheries industries are the most destructive institutions and processes on the earth today, ecologically. That is just by far worse than the petroleum industry and so forth. This system is causing mass extinction, biodiversity losses, you know, using up all the scarce water resources, and I could go on and on, pollution of the seas, you know, through algal blooms and so forth. It's endless, the ecological destructiveness of these systems. But if we think the problem is that we're not doing this in a way that is, quote, sustainable, we're missing the big picture. And the big picture is we shouldn't be doing it at all. That it's the wrong way to go about living a human life. Humans have the choice of what to eat and how to eat, you know, and how to grow our food and so on. That makes us different because we're omnivores, right? We're not obligate carnivores. Means it's up to us to choose the kind of life we want to live. And that's different from, say, the lion who, as an obligate carnivore, has to eat the gazelle, right? And paradoxically or ironically, the more we talk about the problem of animal agriculture as a problem for us, in the sense, prudentially, in terms of it backfiring through climate change, for example. Okay, so the livestock sector, it produces more anthropogenic greenhouse gases than the entire transportation sector. You know, the Biden administration is going on about, you know, set new guidelines, new goals, right, and standards for electric vehicles in the United States, electric cars. And that is smaller. That's a smaller contributing factor, automobiles and trucks, you know, and planes even, throw those in, than animal agriculture, which is not, no one's talking about. But, you know, the irony of this, our situation, is that unless we can learn to care about the other beings that we're exterminating, both through extinction and through quotidian slaughter, we ourselves will go extinct. But the irony, again, is that it's this one. I think the one is prior to the other. We have to first learn to have an ethics of compassion and respect for other beings before we can begin to protect ourselves.
I'm in conversation with philosopher John Sanban Matsu about his forthcoming book, The Omnivore's Deception. I'm also joined in the studio here by Patrick Newman. Patrick, the last thing he mentioned about focusing on the ethics, morality, questions of suffering.
Yeah, well, that's a really powerful quote you read there. That's brilliantly stated. When I think about the dialectic going on here between Michael Pollan's work and the thesis that you're developing there, and so as we talk about this, I'm reminded of my first impression of Pollan's book, which was, what year did that come out? You just said.
It came out in 2006.
Okay, 2006. So that's 15 years ago. And I'm ashamed to say that I was kind of taken by his approach at that point in my life. And in the intervening 15 years, I would say especially the last 10, I began to track in a very different direction from what I was taken with there. But what occurs to me listening to this conversation is that as we try to do our moral work, there's a whole process or a whole, there's a culture in our culture of ways of kind of making that moral work more difficult to do. Like we nuance things and we tend to turn away. You have a great quote from Melville in your book where he talks about this. Once we're sort of invested in something, we tend to turn away from the sort of the moral challenge of it. And so what I think now more and more is that what Pollan does is he offers us a way to really avoid the fundamental question. And in other words, what I think happens with these kinds of approaches is that for the person who reads a book like that, what it does, rather than challenge a person to live a different life, is that it sort of opens up a possibility for a more ideal approach to what's really a moral failure. And by opening up that more ideal approach, what happens is that we default back to the behaviors that we're already more or less addicted to. So in other words, someone can read that book and go, okay, well, I'm gonna grab a little bit of, you know, locally produced this or that at the farmer's market or whatever. But fundamentally, what it does is it gets us off the hook from looking at the deeper question, which is what you're bringing up. And that deeper question is there a moral imperative here that involves a really radical change in the way that we approach these things? And that leads to, you know, in my way of thinking, it leads to contrition, it leads to sacrifice, it leads to looking at the suffering footprint of everything that we're doing. That's not where The Omnivore's Dilemma leads. The Omnivore as a book, where it leads is, how do you get to where you can go on consuming these products, but do it in a more sustainable way, and even enhance your experience so that there's a sort of hedonistic element in the whole process? In other words, what I'm trying to say here in a long-winded way is that moral work and moral thinking can be diverted by approaches that sort of offer us some kind of ennobling approach that doesn't really get to the question of what's really embedded in our behavior at a deeper level. So I think it's brilliant that you're approaching this whole thing in the way that you are.
Thank you. If I could just comment briefly on that, you know, I completely agree with you. And a chapter in my book is on bad faith, which is a concept that the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre developed to describe the way we avoid the kinds of self-reflection and changes in behavior, right, that would lead to a more authentic and honest form of life, you know. So we deceive ourselves about things because it's hard, right? And this is an old problem in the human condition, you know, going back to, you know, the ancient Greeks and the Bible and so on. Just that we just don't want to examine our lives. We don't want to ask, as you say, you know, the deeper, bigger questions that might unsettle us. And Pollan's book in particular, and I should be clear that my book is in conversation at times with Michael Pollan's work. And there are a couple chapters in particular where I take his book on. But I do want to clarify, the book isn't completely about him. But that said, if you reread Omnivore's Dilemma today, I think what two things might strike you. One is, as you were saying, Pat, there's this hedonistic element. I mean, the idea is, yeah, let's just create a more refined palate. Let's seek even higher highs. And it's interesting, now that I even say that, that Pollan's latest work is about hallucinogens, right? He's been doing hallucinogenic drugs and then writing bestsellers about that. But in a way, he was already seeking these highs and bringing middle class, mostly white educated consumers on board with this idea that, you know, they could have their, as I said, their meat and their consciences too, that the problems of corporate agriculture could be somehow thwarted or overcome or mitigated through better consumption and new entrepreneurial companies like Joel Salatin's Polyface Farms and so on. But what I argue in my book is that, so that's one part that I think would leap out to many readers today. But as I argue in my book, this came, you know, in the middle of the war on terror, right? The post 9/11 environment. And it's in my reading, it's of a piece with what was going on in that time, kind of sublimated aggression, which is exhibited in this particular work, Pollan's, especially in the way he highlights, and this is the second point I wanted to make, highlights the killing of animals. He goes out of his way in the course of researching this book to personally kill dozens of animals with his own hands and then writing about it. So he's, and I, you know, I could go into that, but it's morally repugnant in my view. And the way he, even though he feels a little uncomfortable with it, his moral, he suppresses any moral qualms he might have because of how good the meat tastes, you know. So there's this valorization of, you know, pollen's own aesthetic pleasures, his highs, valorization of that counterposed with this ruthless violence where pollen goes out hunting, takes a high-powered rifle, goes out in the woods and kills this mother pig. And then he's just, it's this point of kind of manly apotheosis for pollen, where he describes himself as having a, quote, shit-eating grin. These, you know, it's not about pollen, of course. It's about the wider culture and the way that aggression towards other beings is the basis of our social organization, right? I mean, we have this structure, these institutions, these practices, these norms of mass violence. And part of the book is about confronting the obvious contradiction in the fact that someone who goes out hunting will maybe have a beloved hunting dog at their side. Someone who contributes to the Audubon Society, which protects birds, will sit down, you know, over duck or chicken, you know, eating a nice meal of birds and not think of any contradiction. But in no other domain of moral experience that I am aware of would we accept such plainly, blatantly contradictory.
I need to let you know that the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by
child abuse.
The Northern California Autism Symposium. Return to philosophy.
There, what's coming up for me when I hear what you're describing now is one of my favorite essays, which, you know, I've mentioned to Robert many times when we talked about it. It's called The First Step by Leo Tolstoy. And what's interesting about that is that if you look at the agricultural context in which that essay is written, it's an essay that begins with Tolstoy's awakening to what's happening in a slaughterhouse and the moral implications of that. Where his moral compass is pointing, this is the turn of the last century, somewhere around 1900. I don't remember the exact date of that essay. It's probably 1880 something. But he describes in very graphic terms this, what happens in a slaughterhouse. And he talks about, you know, the moral implications of that in this essay and goes on to describe the moral implications of consumerism in general, really, of his class of people and what the cost of that is. What's kind of interesting to me right now is that as I think about this, the context that Pullen's describing when he talks about sustainable agriculture, that was the agriculture of Tolstoy's time. Yet we have Tolstoy with this moral compass recognizing that, hey, there's some kind of unnecessary suffering happening here and I need to address that. There's moral work involved here that I have to dig deeper into that. So what Pullen's doing is really looking at the context Tolstoy was in and not accepting Tolstoy's thesis. But now we're rolling forward. We have, like you've described very well, a global holocaust of suffering because we have industrial agriculture on a global scale. And if we had looked more deeply into what Tolstoy was asking us to look at 100 and some odd years ago, our moral compass would have pointed us in an entirely different direction than where we ended up today. So it's like, it's almost doubling the mistake. It's not, it's again, refusing to look more deeply at the whole question of, is this necessary suffering? Is the suffering that's associated with this particular kind of consumption something that I can justify or can't justify? That's really the fundamental question. And we, for, you know, thousands of years, we've mostly avoided, you know, looking deeply at that. And it's led us to now what's really an environmental catastrophe on a scale that, you know, we've never seen before.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that essay by Tolstoy. I only encountered it in recent years, and it's so powerful. And I really recommend that listeners check it out. You know, it gives this very detailed, very moving and sickening account of a visit to a slaughterhouse. We've seen live animals being killed. And there's a strange nostalgia among the locavores for the good old days of animal agriculture, right? When supposedly the animals were killed humanely and treated well. And this, I mean, it's what's incredible is that so many of the boosters of this new pastoralism, people not only like Pollan, but Barbara Kingsolver, who's a leftist author, who's and fine novelist, who the following year in 2007 published Animal Vegetable Miracle, an account of raising animals for slaughter on her family's organic farm. Anyway, there are just lots of these folks who nominally and not just nominally identify with the left or progressivism in some form, who nonetheless invoke these reactionaries, the only word for it, reactionary myths about the good old days of animal agriculture, which were never good. I mean, critiques, ethical critiques of our violence against animals extend back at least 2,500 years, probably closer to 3,000 years, right? There's a fascinating history to that. So people think, when people hear about veganism today or PETA, you know, the animal rights group, they think, oh, well, this is a fad. This is like some a precious project of, you know, some elite or whatever, however people think about it. This critique goes back a very long, long, long time. And when someone like Pollan, you know, defends this and then gussies it up as new and ethical and a solution to our ecological problems and the food system, it's intellectually dishonest, as well as a kind of, not sure what the word is, it goes against true moral thought. I mean, it's fundamentally unethical, you know, at some level, the way he handles these questions. And the other thing is the fraud of the whole project is, of course, that you cannot have 7 or 8, 9, 10 billion human beings eating flesh every day without horrific suffering. You brought up the question of suffering, right? And without industrialized animal agriculture. You just can't do it. It's a non-starter. But there's a legitimation function involved in telling people, oh, well, if you just start hunting, you know, your own food, that's called, locavores call that shopping, you know, picking up a gun and killing some deer, or, you know, having these littler, smaller, sustainable farms. Well, frankly, actually, you know, raising cattle for slaughter on a feedlot is more environmentally friendly than grazing them, putting them out to pasture, because they produce more CO2. Quote, free range pasteurized ruminants, right? They just produce more methane. So everything about this is fraudulent, but again, I think it comes down to a kind of existential identity. We do not want to relinquish our supremacy over all of the other millions of species, you know, thousands of species.
That's the voice of John Sanbanmatsu, philosopher and author of the forthcoming The Omnivore's Deception. You're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. I'm also joined in the studio by local environmental and homeless activist, Patrick Newman. John, I wanted to pick up on something that you said, a couple of things that you said. There's two ways we can go. So first of all, number one, for those who may not know, I teach at the University at Chico State in the philosophy department, and I have I've instituted a course, a general education course, an animal rights course, in which I talk about the connections between animal rights and environmental collapse, and also these issues of individual animal suffering and the relations that we have to them. And it's no surprise, because I mentioned before that the university has a big ag program. I get a number of agriculture students. I've spent many hours in discussion with people at the university, students and faculty, with regard to animal agriculture. Here's something I hear often. I hear people say, when I talk about the way that animals are slaughtered, or I talk about the really highly sophisticated cognitive and emotional and psychological capacities of, quote, farm animals like cows and pigs and chickens, here's a common response. It's like, look, I have 40 pigs that I raise. I love my pigs. You know, you're not a pig farmer. You're a city slicker. And so to paint me, pig farmer, as someone who has malintent, someone who gets joy out of slaughtering the pig, I don't. The pig serves the purpose. It has a good life, and I facilitate that. And then, yes, it has, quote, one bad day at the slaughterhouse. But I actually, you know, love and care for my animals. That is one strand that I want to talk about. I want to tie it into another strand, and that is, you write the following in your book. You say, quote, two systems are driving the mass extinction crisis and the ecological emergency more generally. Human domination, or what you call, quote, speciesism, and capitalism. So this notion of speciesism, can you inform us, what is this notion of speciesism? How does this connect to my students and farmers I speak with, who think I'm really not doing anything wrong, and the pig is fulfilling a place in the natural order. I'm fulfilling a place in the natural order. So what I'm trying to connect the dots here with you on is the question of moral responsibility, the question of individuals and our responsibilities to these non-human animals, and the question of this, quote, natural order, and also this notion of speciesism. So maybe you can take that and take all of that and run with it.
Thank you, Robert. There's so many different layers to this that I can only touch on a few of the themes that you've raised. First of all, in my opinion, it's simply obvious and incontrovertible that one cannot love what one seeks to destroy. And it bothers me very much when people say, oh, well, I love my animal, you know, the animals that I'm raising. If you're raising animals in order to be killed, that shows that you have nothing but contempt, ultimately, for the worth of their lives. That's bottom line. You cannot respect a being that you are trying to expunge from existence. And I'm not sure exactly why people have such a hard time understanding that. I mean, one thing that these farmers and students in your classes might want to think about is, well, would I treat my pet dog this way? You know, if I am raising a dog, or a human child for that matter, and I give that dog or that child a pleasant life for a few years, and then I take the dog or child in the backyard and slit its throat, we wouldn't say, well, oh, well, yeah, I treated the dog or the child well, except it was just one bad day. I mean, it's grotesque. I just want to say that. Now, you touched on so many different themes here. One of them has to do with the romance of farming, right? And then this idea of the natural order. So the pig's function, in your example, is to die. The pig is, that's the meaning of life in a way. Death is part of life. It's part of the life cycle. And of course, animals are meant to be used by other animals, more dominant ones, more powerful ones. These ideas, which I explore in my book, go back to a time in human civilization when humans bought and sold one another as slaves, believed that the earth was flat, and committed all manner of atrocities to one another. There was no such thing as human rights or equality. Women were basically property. That's where these ideas come from, this idea of a natural hierarchical order in which more dominant or powerful or superior beings do what they will to weaker, more vulnerable ones. We are still living in this system to this day. And Pat, you work with around homeless issues. that's totally the same thing. You know, well, they're on the bottom of the food chain, aren't they, the homeless? You know, we don't eat the homeless, but we don't think that their lives, we don't value their lives as much as we value the lives of, you know, corporate shareholders or whatnot. So it's simply a fallacy to suggest that when we sexually reproduce other beings, mutilate their bodies, exploit their labor or their bodies for our purposes, and then violently dispatch them, that that is somehow natural. It is cultural, basically property. That's where these ideas come from, this idea of a natural hierarchical order in which more dominant or powerful or superior beings do what they will to weaker, more vulnerable ones. We are still living in this system to this day. And Pat, you work with around homeless issues. That's totally the same thing. You know, well, they're on the bottom of the food chain, aren't they, the homeless? You know, we don't eat the homeless, but we don't think that their lives, we don't value their lives as much as we value the lives of, you know, corporate shareholders or whatnot. So it's simply a fallacy to suggest that when we sexually reproduce other beings, mutilate their bodies, exploit their labor or their bodies for our purposes, and then violently dispatch them, that that is somehow natural. It is cultural. It is not natural. There's nothing more or less natural about animal farming than the minimum wage or Netflix or nuclear bombs. These are human institutional practices, cultural practices, that have values encoded in them. And there are choices in those, encoded in those values as well. And so the reason I just want to say, sorry to go on so long, but the reason I wrote this book is it took me 15 years to come to terms with the Michael Pollans of the world and to try to unpack it over the course, you know, over 300 pages, because it's so, there's so many layers of deception and lies and myth making around the question of meat that it required a book length treatment. So we just want to be clear to your listeners here that we're just touching the surface of these problems.
And John, can you speak to speciesism? I'm sure that most listeners have no idea what that would even amount to.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So speciesism is a term that's been in use for some decades. I can't remember now who originally coined it. Peter Singer, in his book Animal Liberation, uses it. And that book came out in 1975. The way I'm using speciesism is as a way of producing human life premised on the domination, exploitation, and killing of other beings. And so I call this a mode of production or mode of producing human life that is, as I've been saying, is central to our identity and central to our economic organization as well. You know, so speciesism is that system. It's both an idea of dominance, right, of domination, and also it's the totality of the structures that affect our control over these other beings. And that, and so it's not just in animal agriculture. I'm talking speciesism encompasses experimentation on animals in laboratories, imprisoning animals in aquariums and zoos for our entertainment, bulldozing a forest where other beings, sensitive, intelligent beings, live out their lives to put in, you know, a superhighway without giving it a thought. All of that would come under the umbrella of speciesism. And all of that is hypercharged by capitalism. You mentioned capitalism, right? And that, so capitalism is the driving dynamic that has led to our cannibalizing the earth. Today, the IPCC, the United Nations, just put out a report warning us that the global warming is leading us into a total catastrophe. But that report doesn't mention speciesism, which is a big, and doesn't mention capitalism either. So the two big structures that have led to the destruction, are rapidly leading to the destruction of even our own species, are not mentioned. So naming the problem, I think, is really important. And those are the two institutions that I address in my book.
That's the voice of philosopher John Sanban Matsu, author of the forthcoming The Omnivore's Deception, joining us via Zoom. In the studio with me, I have Patrick Newman, local homeless and environmental activist.
You value KZFR and we value you. Together, we are the best people-powered radio station serving the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Chico News and Reviews, Best of Chico's back, and voting is live for Best of Chico 2021. You can vote for your favorite goods, services, restaurants, and people. Let the best of our community get the glory they deserve. It's easy to vote, and you can vote for the mighty Zephyr, KZFR 90.1 FM, for Best Radio Station under the Community category. See a complete list of KZFR's wonderful supporters to vote for them also on KZFR.org under the Underwriters tab. Don't wait. The deadline for Best of Chico voting is September 5th, so vote today, now, on the Chico News and Review website, or go to www.chicobestof.com.
John, you raised this issue of welfareism versus abolition, and Patrick, I believe, you know, we had a little discussion about the parallels between welfareism and abolition and the parallels between that and in homeless advocacy, the notions of charity versus justice and these kinds of connections. I was hoping you could tease that out for us.
Oh, yeah. So just as an aside, that this whole question of once you start with a premise, you know, the premise that these isms are really assailable. In other words, that what we've established in terms of our devices to avoid looking at our culpability, when you really start to get underneath that and look at all the parallels between different elements of our lives with this, with respect to this, there is this parallel between what seems to me to be the welfare rights split in the animal, you know, domain versus the charity justice split in the question of, you know, how we approach our destitute fellow human beings. So there's a kind of, I would say within this discussion of homelessness, when you get that kind of destitution and that kind of suffering, people will respond very differently to it. And often the charity response presupposes that the hierarchical structure that we're all living within, the water that we swim in, actually makes sense. And through that lens, you can simply offer charity to a person who's at that level in the socioeconomic structure without looking more deeply at whether where they are in that socioeconomic structure makes any sense at all to begin with. A person can also look at that, question that more deeply, look at it more radically, and then say, wait a minute, this isn't a question of charity here. This is a question of justice. This is a question of what that person's rights are. So, of course, you have that split in with respect to animals where people look at them and they feel things like pity and compassion and all kinds of things like that, and then they offer kindness. That's very different than looking at the animal population saying, what rights do these creatures have? What rights to, you know, freedom and, well, freedom from the infliction of harm that we bring? So I find these, I mean, I think that those dichotomies are going to emerge at every point where you have, where you've assigned value to something based on either a hierarchical model or an exploitation model versus a model that says, wait a minute, at its core, isn't there a moral issue here that goes deeper and really questions what our relationships are with each other, other human beings, other animals and our ecosystems? So anyway, it's a whole kind of interesting, set of parallels.
Yeah, could I just respond to that? I mean, that's really great. And I agree with everything you just said. And, you know, I frame animal issues as much as I can as a question of justice, right? Animal justice, which is a term you mentioned, justice. But I would only just add that there's another dimension to this question, you know, of homelessness and then what I'm seeing in the animal movement, which is a liberal versus radical approach. I mean, that's implicit, I think, in what you're saying, but take homelessness. Is the solution to homelessness to build more homeless shelters? Is the solution to homelessness to have more food pantries? I mean, that's kind of the liberal approach. How about let's look at the commodification of housing, the fact that the banks right, and capitalist control all of human society, including the housing market and rents and so forth. So the word radical, from radius, Latin for roots, tries to look at the root of the problem. The reason that animals are, quote, abused in agriculture, I mean, literally tortured. I could give examples of the way they're literally tortured on farms, is not because of a few bad apples on the farm. It's because the nature of the institution, the structure, is one of violence. And similarly, the reason the homeless are homeless is not because they're homeless. It's because we live in a society that has disenfranchised workers, right, and poor people, and created a bifurcated society between the propertyless and the property. So unless you deal with the property relation, it's no point, almost, you know, in tackling homelessness or poverty issues.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. It's a fundamental question of wealth distribution. And so real estate, property, shelter, those are a form of wealth. And how we distribute that wealth is, you know, it's a reflection of how just a society we are. And I mean, we're one of the few countries in the world that didn't ratify the UN Declaration on Human Rights. One of those rights is to shelter. It's a fundamental human right. And so, you know, given the way we've approached wealth distribution, we're violating at a core level fundamental human rights. And there's a lot, it's systemic. There's a tremendous amount of support in the system for doing it exactly the way we do it, while at the same time, in this sort of schizophrenic way, we've got, you know, people trying to put out this fire. But the fire is clearly burning because we're not addressing the fundamental questions, just like you just said. Yeah, that's really well said. So, I mean, my reflection on that is just that when it comes to doing moral work, and that means looking at what our payoff is, our culpability, in other words, or culpability / payoff, these isms that you're talking about, like speciesism and racism and sexism and classism, they're all devices that allow us to frame the suffering we create, which is really sort of at the core of the whole thing. Like, that is, as I create unnecessary suffering, I create a moral problem. So then if I'm looking at that moral problem, I have to look at all those devices that I use to allow myself to go on doing that so that I can get the payoff that I'm getting out of it. And that's where it all gets ugly, because you're looking beyond those devices or underneath the way that we contrive to avoid taking responsibility and doing the moral work that comes with that responsibility. So that's like speciesism is one of the most powerful devices when it comes to avoiding looking at suffering and getting the information that's in the suffering. Because once I have that device, I don't have to go very far. It's like the person that talks about having affection for their animals and being involved in some sort of profit-making enterprise or whatever's associated with the payoff. Once you have that device in place, you have a well-supported version of reality that tells you don't have to look beyond that device. And that device gets you off the hook. So
that's the voice of Patrick Newman, local environmental and homeless activist. Joining me in the studio via Zoom, I have philosopher John Sabanmatsu, who is the author of the forthcoming The Omnivore's Deception. And we're talking about the effects of speciesism, the effects of, say, animal agriculture on the destruction pretty much of the planet as we know it. You're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. John, I wanted to touch on something you actually brought up in passing, but I think is a rather, many would say, a provocative section of your book, in which you talk about abolitionism. Most listeners associate abolitionism with the anti-slavery movement in Western Europe and in the United States from the 18th and 19th centuries. This notion of abolitionism also applies to the case of the exploitation and destruction of animals for human profit. And you made an analogy to slavery. that's going to upset a number of people thinking, first of all, there's a long, ugly history of comparing the subjects of slavery, particularly African-Americans, animalizing them. So there's that issue. And then there's the question of, well, how could you compare the animal suffering to human suffering? And how dare you compare animal agriculture to slavery? So there is this question of abolition of slavery and it's being appropriated for the issue of the exploitation of animals. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on this question in my book, and it's really, really important. I mean, I was warned by a very good friend of mine when I was planning this book not to talk about slavery because it would get people's hackles up, you know, and I'd be accused of racism and so on. The first point I would make is that slavery, the human institution, which of course derived, it didn't emerge with Europe. Slavery is an institution that goes back thousands and thousands of years, you know, to the ancient Egyptians and before. I mean, so we're talking about a very, very long-lived institution, which most historians, at least the ones I've read and anthropologists, believe was based on the prior enslavement of non-human animals. In other words, what we call domestication, which begins in the Neolithic period about 11,000 years ago, so-called domestication became the basis, the model for enslaving human beings, for sexually reproducing human beings and commodifying their bodies and exploiting their labor and their intelligence. I mean, that's just a fact. So it's not like I'm making, you know, this provocative thing in order to saying this to be provocative. There are several books on this. There's The Dreaded Comparison by Marjorie Spiegel. There's Eternal Treblinka by Charles Patterson that outline the in great detail the ideological, technological, institutional parallels between human enslavement of other animals and human enslavement of other humans. In the 9th century, for example, a group of Islamic scholars who call themselves the Brethren of Purity in what's now Basra, Iraq, wrote a nearly 200-page treatise called The Case of the Animals versus Man before the King of the Jinn or the Genie, in which the animals of the earth bring a legal case against the human race for their brutality towards them in hunting and agriculture and so on. And they outline just page after page of this horrific violence and suffering imposed on by the human race on all the other beings. And in the course of that narrative, the animals say they're appealing to the court and saying, well, they treat us like slaves. And the humans respond, yes, well, you are our slaves. Aristotle in the Politics talks about when he's justifying human slavery, he basically says, you know, a poor family who wants to have slaves in Greece and Athens will get oxen instead. So, you know, if you look at the Hammurabi Code, which is the first ethical code ever put together in print, slaves, human slaves and animal slaves are essentially interchangeable. So that's the first thing. Now, when we get to the antebellum period and we talk about modern slavery, which is racialized slavery, it's extraordinary what I found was extraordinary is the same. I mean, literally the same arguments that people like Michael Pollan, Barbara Kingsolver and so forth are making today to justify animal agriculture. They are the same rationales that were used both in the world, you know, in ancient antebellum period to justify human slavery. So, as I say, there are techniques and technologies that I could describe, you know, that were applied from, you know, that were first used on non-human species and then were applied to human slaves. But more interesting to me than that really is the ideological mechanisms that people use. Final thing I'll say is on the question of abolition, that there's been a debate raging within the animal advocacy movement for decades, a debate between the animal welfarists who want to basically make the cages bigger and make the chains longer, and then the abolitionists who say, no, it's time for humans to simply stop exploiting and harming other animals. So I have no problem myself, you know, referring to abolition or defending, advocating for the abolition of our many harms against animals.
Peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state and local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or to have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice, right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For more details, see squaredealmattress.com. I wanted to touch on something that you both raised. When we identify an axis of injustice, let's say, we have this systemic failure with regard to the homeless situation. We have the systemic failure with regard to animal agriculture. At the level of the individual, and we tend in the United States and in capitalist cultures to see individuals as, quote, consumers, right? Primarily as consumers. So we have all these individuals that aggregate into the culture who make these individual decisions about what to do with our dollars and what to consume. And the implication is that we as individuals have a moral imperative to alter our own lifestyle. So I want to juxtapose that with this issue of the systemic failures. And at the level of the systemic failure, you get someone like Bill McKibben who's going to say, look, the problem is the fossil fuel companies. The implication is that me as the individual, when I go to a fast food burger joint and I go and I get my burger and I eat my burger and I have the plastic packaging and I throw that away. So on the one hand, it's like, what else can I do as an individual? I'm just living in the system. So don't put it on me that I have to make individual moral choices to make this place better, because it's coming. It's a top-down phenomenon from the failure of the system. And on the other hand, the individual consumers, we as individuals have the power to make choices that will have a bottom-up effect within the system, within the capitalist system. So is this really a dichotomy between the individual choices, or does it require systemic level change that me as an individual, I feel totally disempowered? I want to put on the table this issue of individual moral responsibility versus systemic change and where the responsibility lies with regard to upending the system, with regard to, you know, a radical solution.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great set of questions. Just briefly, I'd just say that what sociologists call voluntaristic solutions are not really solutions. I mean, look at taking out the recycling. I am like fanatical about my recycling, and it doesn't matter because there's no market for recycled products, paper products, due to the vagaries of the capitalist market and lack of government incentives and so on. That I'm still going to do that. And I'm a vegan and I won't eat animal products, but I don't pat myself on the back and think, well, my God, I've done my duty for the day, because the number of animals being killed is simply increasing. The difficulty of our time for all of us, those of us, you know, here in this virtual space and listeners, is that social movements have collapsed. Progressive left feminist social movements have collapsed. This is a long-term trend. It's a very spiritually difficult time. It's very difficult to feel optimistic. It's very difficult to imagine or to affect strategies of social change at this historical juncture. And we have to acknowledge that. The fact is that, as you said, Robert, you know, us interpolated as individual players is a problem in itself. We need collective action. We need institutional change. We need, I would say, revolutionary change, absolutely revolution, not reforms. We need complete changes in an economy and society. But I don't have the magic bullet. I mean, I'm filled with despair, as many of us are when we're confronted. I mean, people are aware of the climate crisis, and very few people, in my experience, are aware of the mass extinction crisis, which is a much worse problem. People don't even know that that's going on. And to the extent that they know extinctions are going on, they think it's climate change that's causing it. And it isn't. That isn't the main driver of extinctions. So it's, that is to say, it's all very overwhelming. And it's easy for us to feel, therefore, that the only thing we can do is to act within the individual realm. So I'll just conclude by saying that the danger is, on the one hand, if we see these big structural systemic problems, we may lapse into bad faith. And I know some, I won't name any, who say, oh, well, then I'm just going to leave the lights on all night because it doesn't matter anyway. Or I'm not going to eat vegan because, you know, it's not going to make a difference what I do. It's like the same people who don't vote, right? Because their votes aren't going to count, which they're also right about to some extent. But so that's one danger. But the other danger is to, to say, well, we can't do anything structurally. And that's the dilemma we're kind of in. I mean, we need structural change, but right now there's so many things thwarting that. I could list them. I won't, but so many reasons why it's so hard to think about social change right now. Pat, what's your thought?
To me, it's there are really two sides of the same coin. There must be a better analogy than that. But for us to do individual moral work and make individual moral progress and to become morally literate and to, I guess, go through some kind of process of moral transformation in relation to all the stuff we've been talking about, I think it's the grassroots driver in social change, ultimately. This is how I look at things. But equally important is that there has to be some kind of collective systemic motion, and that has to come from some sort of, I guess, big solution perspective. So I don't think one can happen without the other. I think they're really interdependent. I guess if I had to pick one, I would say that if we don't do moral work as individuals, then there isn't any possible synergy that can lead to collective action because we don't have individuals that are capable of doing it. So, I mean, I am in despair. I don't see a moral revolution happening in our society. I don't think we've done our moral work. And there's this wonderful quote from you that stuck out to me. But we have now let our technological dreams outrun our moral imaginations. That's at the root of a lot of the despair that I feel, because I feel like we're in this time of, you know, tsunami-like technological change. And at every point, when we look at all of these, you know, moral questions over thousands of years, there's always been a technological driver that's come with those changes. Even something like enslaving the first animals required very simple technologies to do that. This tsunami, in order to, I guess, retain some of my own sanity, all I can do is try to do the work in an existential sense, you know, and it's largely individual, but it doesn't mean that I could eat vegan and then not look at what I would say, let's just say in our Chico, you know, little Petri dish, we have systemic oppression of the homeless, for example, among other systemic oppressions. Can I just eat vegan and not engage on that systemic level? Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me either, or any other individual act that I could do. I think they're intertwined.
I agree. You know, there's a lot of talk in academic circles of in activist circles of intersectionality. The injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Martin Luther King said, right? I mean, the problem is the more we learn as individuals about the horrible state of the world, I mean, the suffering of people in the Sudan from starvation, we could list 100 problems. And it's hard to keep those all kind of in the tension of our minds and not feel overwhelmed. But justice is made of whole cloth. And as you say, Pat, you know, we need, it's a dialectical relationship between the self and the world. We need to work on our own moral resilience, spiritual resilience, and then to seek solidarity with others. And unfortunately, you know, you mentioned technology. Technology is just one of these forces that is driving us apart in certain ways and making it harder to envision those big big scale ideas and possible solutions. And that's a whole other question we didn't get to today, but the crisis of intellectual thought, and I would say of left intellectual thought in particular, there's just such a dearth of creative thinking on the left. It's really pathetic. And so we're just in this mode of reacting constantly to one catastrophe after another, and it's a losing battle, ultimately.
Well, John, you mentioned that most people think the reason for the mass extinction crisis is global warming, when in fact, the thesis of your book is that it's due to speciesism and capitalism. And that leads me to this question: can there be justice within a capitalist system?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. I mean, but I have some bad news for apolitical vegan listeners, which is that the answer is unfortunately no. I mean, you said, well, can we have justice? Let's just say, can we just have animal justice? Let's not even talk about human justice, right? Can we have animal justice if everyone goes out and eats a vegan burrito? Well, certainly it would be better off for the animals. But remember, as I argue in the book, many ecological socialists been outlining these arguments for decades. Capitalism is a system that is hardwired to commodify nature and to reduce it to the status of cheap raw material. So that, basically it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. If I'm giving money to Cargill for a vegan burger and Cargill's destroying a rainforest in order to grow palm oil, as it's done, in Asia and so forth, it's not getting at the root of the problem. So the bad news is no, I don't think so. If there's a way the capitalism could be not lethal to human and animal life, then I'd be the first in line for it. But we have 500 years of history to look at, as well as, we can theorize the dynamics that are internal to capital to see why we end up with these disasters. But no, it's not a reformable system. And unfortunately, liberals like Paul Krugman at the Times or whatever are under this delusion that capitalism can be reformed and tamed. And there's no evidence for it. I mean, we have every evidence to the contrary, right? I mean, who controls the Congress? It's the corporations. It's the donors, wealthy donors. I mean, Democrats and Republicans alike. So I'm afraid the news is not so good in that front, Robert. Can't just have your vegan burrito. Sorry.
Oh, well, yeah. I think capitalism is our latest version of, the organized crime that Robert and I have talked about a little bit. This question of capitalism versus all the other, systems that we've had, feudalism, et cetera, I think it's the latest version of something that's the worm at the core of the apple. So if you look at these systems, this particular one, capitalism, is enabled in its present form by technologies that have emerged in the last 500 years that make it possible. So what we have is as you say in this quote, we have technological dreams and they are outrunning our capacity to think morally, because the more this technological power grows, the more there's a moral imperative to address it with moral thinking and justice and all these other questions. So I see capitalism, in other words, as another version of some similarly exploitative models. And they all have many parallels between them. But it's at its core, at the core of it all, the question is, can civilization with any sort of hierarchical structure, which seems to be innate to civilization, can that be redeemed on a moral basis? And that's a really deep and difficult question. But so far, we haven't figured out a way to do that.
Well, John, I'm sure at one level, you'll agree that capitalism is a further iteration of a particular oppressive and hierarchical exploitative system. However, do you see something particularly pernicious about capitalism versus these other sort of hierarchical models of exploitation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important question. I mean, because on the one hand, human societies have always, in the main anyway, the larger structures have been based on exploitation and violence. And I think, part of the argument I have with ecological Marxists is they don't want to acknowledge that before capitalism, there was such a thing as speciesism or human domination. And but so it's not like capitalism created all the problems in the world. On the other hand, as you're suggesting, capitalism has unique dynamics and a unique logic that put it at odds with human happiness and with the ecosystem, period. I mean, literally in the last 40 years, let's say 60 to 70% of all the animals on the earth, wild animals, free animals, have died. That's in the space of 40 years. How is that possible? It's because of the commodity system and because of the way nature is destroyed under capital. No question about it. I mean, I teach a whole 7-week course on capitalism, and we barely scratch the surface. There's a lot to be said about why capitalism has, you know, is uniquely destructive to society and the individual and animals. I think what's sobering to think about, though, is that humans have made a mess of a lot of other things too. I mean, you know, the communist experiment in the Soviet Union didn't work out so hot, right? Bolshevik Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. We need to eat some humble pie on the left and to rethink our basic categories and our conception of the relationship between power and democracy and so on. Because I'm not trying to be fatalistic here and say there's no solution, but overthrowing capitalism isn't the only thing we have to do. I'll just quote, I'll leave you with this last thought. Henrik Ibsen, the great Norwegian playwright, said, you know, people talk about revolutions in society and the economy and so forth, but what's really needed is a revolution of the human mind. Now, he said this back in the, you know, I don't know, 1860s, 1870s, and he was right. So we all have our work cut out for ourselves, but we have to somehow keep the hope going, and broadcasts like this are helpful for helping us to think through these thorny problems. So I want to thank you, Robert, for having us on today.
Well, Patrick Newman, thank you for joining.